Daz, you know I've never seen the original Battlestar Galactica?
You'd hate it.
Really? Wait. Now I'm offended. I'd hate it?
You'd hate, yeah.
Excuse me? Sell me on the original Battlestar Galactica. What did you like about it? Or is it just something that you think most people wouldn't like?
It was very much of its time. I personally loved it. There wasn't a lot of sci-fi in those days. And this was like, I was just the right age for it, because it was like a really, really fun show. It was like, you know, lots of action, you know, lots of fight scenes and everything. It was one of those shows where they used to reuse the same footage, right, week in, week out. You know, whenever we had a space battle, it was always, you know, the one set of footage that they'd shot, they basically would sort of like, you know, show you just in different ways to make it like a new battle. But anyway, I personally loved it, and I think a lot of people, if you ask them, who were basically sort of, anyone who says that they didn't like it and they were kids in that time is probably lying, because everyone sort of, you know, everyone really, really enjoyed it. It was just a really fun for its time sci-fi show, and I have fun memories of it.
Yes, there's a reason why you had to specifically pick out that intro this week. Am I correct, Taza?
Yeah, it's very sad news that Richard Hatch, who was in the original show as Apollo, who was sort of the main star, along with Dirk Benedict as Starbuck. They were two sort of the two main characters. He sadly passed away this week, and really sad news. And the thing about Richard Hatch is he was a star of the original TV show, but he was one of the people that basically kept. He basically kept, you know, in with the fan interest afterwards. He was basically always pitching for a reboot of the show. He wrote a couple of novelizations and stuff, and he was very sort of active on the fan circuit. And unfortunately, his vision never actually got made into the TV show that he wanted, but he did them. When the new Battlestar Galactica TV show, a few years back came around, he actually appeared in that as Zarek, you know, a totally brand new character who was basically one of the best characters on the show. He was on every episode, but he was a recurring character, and he was basically a revolutionary who was in jail at the time that the Cylons invaded destroyed all the colonies. And so he was basically one of the, he basically carried on these sort of revolutionary ways. He would basically sort of like, you know, did lots of scheming, managed to get himself into the position of vice president, and actually sort of later on, organized a coup against the, you know, and he was, it was rather strangely, even though he was, you know, he was very sort of, he was kind of like what the Magneto is to the X-Men, where he's basically sort of a villainous in his methods. But he actually believes in what he's doing, and he has actually sort of got good, you know, he's actually got good intentions. He just has a very Malcolm X type radical way of doing things. And he was one of my favorite characters in there. Probably one of the few characters that I actually liked in the new version. Cause, you know, it was a great show and everything, but most of the characters were basically, I didn't like. They were sort of hypocrites and jackasses and, you know, military people and stuff, and I wasn't a fan of most of the people, but you know, Richard Hatch, you know, he was in both TV shows, and he will be sadly missed. He was somebody who really obviously had a lot of passion for the show that he did, and like I say, was very active on the fan circuit, and he will be sadly missed.
Yes, it's unfortunate. I never had, like I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, I never had the privilege to watch the show. Maybe with the recent passing of him, I may go back and actually watch it, because, you know, when you sent me that intro, I had to watch the intro of the TV show, and obviously there's aspects of it that have not aged particularly well, but this still looks watchable, and if I can sort of go in there, you know, with maybe a little tongue in cheek, I can get some pleasure out of this. This actually looks. Go ahead. What were you going to say,
Desmond? The two that I would really recommend, and it's a strange one, because in the US it was always a TV show, but in the UK, it first appeared in cinemas, I believe. What they did is the pilot episode, which was like a feature length, they actually showed in cinemas in the UK. And I would really recommend that, you know, the pilot episode. But also, there was another, In the US, it was a two-parter, but they sort of combined it into one episode to make it a feature-length film. And that's called Mission Galactica, the Cylon Attack.
Ah.
And that is a really good, a really fun episode as well to watch. It's got Lloyd Bridges in there as well. Of the ones to watch, that, you know, the pilot and the Cylon Attack one, they're the ones that I would sort of, you know, I would watch those sort of, like, you know, pretty good sort of, you know, just old school sci-fi fantasy fun, I would say.
Yes, I remember the showing in the theater, because I remember when I was first watching the reboot version of Battlestar Galactica, my dad sort of scoffed at it because he remembered the original Battlestar Galactica, and I guess his idea was basically it was a ripoff of Star Wars. I guess when it was coming out, he just basically dismissed it. He's like, oh, that's just a Star Wars ripoff. And, you know, maybe that was the intention at the time when they first got the ball rolling on that, but it very quickly became something else and sort of... I had poisoned the well, because I since then sort of, I wouldn't say seeked out, but I saw that they were showing a version of the original Battlestar Galactica on television, but unfortunately it was the 1980 series, Dazza. Have you seen that?
That was awful. That was.
For those of you go ahead.
I mean, I think the thing about that one is that they wanted to carry on with the Battlestar Galactica series, but they didn't have the budget to basically sort of do all the special things, so they basically brought them all onto Earth to obviously sort of, like, and it was not good. It was not good at all.
And not just Earth, the idea of the planet, it's like, no, Monday 1980s Earth. That's when all the Galactica people show up with their futuristic spaceships and the Cylons that are chasing them.
Yeah, it's pretty dire. And it's one of these things that They pretty much ripped off all of the sort of the classic sci-fi shows as well for ideas for that. You know, basically pretty much any episode was basically something that they'd ripped off from a 50s or 60s sci-fi show. It was quite awful.
All right, let's go on the show, proper intro. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Tony, and you're listening to a brand new episode of Tales from the Couch Zone. And as always, I'm joined by co-host Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent. All right, let's waste no more time, Dazza. We talked Battlestar Galactica, we did our proper intro. Let's go into our first segment this week. Dazza, what movies have you been watching as of late?
Well, it's Oscar season, of course, so I've been watching three films, which are basically also going to feature in the Oscars in one nomination or another. The first one I saw was Hacksaw Ridge, directed by Mel Gibson. And this was a real good film. It stars Andrew Garfield. And the story basically is about it's set during the Second World War. And there's basically a young lad who, he's actually a conscientious objector. He basically doesn't believe in violence, and he doesn't want to taking violence, but he wants to serve his country, and he wants to basically sort of serve in the war. So he basically enlists on the understanding, thinking that he's going to be an actual medic, and he ends up in a rifle group, and he's basically he refuses even to touch a gun to train with and everything. And basically it's about his story, this is actually a true story, how he basically sort of, like, you know, had to overcome basically the bullying and the hazing from his colleagues, and he basically ended up going he wanted to basically serve but not have to carry a gun, so he had to go through the courts and everything, and basically sort of win the right to basically serve and actually sort of go into battle without a gun. And he ended up sort of serving in one of the sort of the big battles there. And it's a really it's a great film. The thing is, it's very old fashioned in many ways. It's got a lot of cliches for a film of this sort of, you know, that's been nominated for an Oscar. Like, for example, early on when he basically sees the woman who's going to be the love of his life, the way it sort of shoots the woman, she suddenly goes into slow motion And she sort of, like, you see as she's walking, she sort of turns and looks at him and her hair's flowing and everything. It's almost like a really old-fashioned, old-school romantic, you know, romantic element to it, you know. And when he basically meets the people he's going to be serving with, he's like introduced to them one by one. It's almost like they've all got like their sort of like their own little gimmicks and tics, you know, like from a sort of like your Second World War movie. So there's one guy who's the really, really handsome one. There's another one who's the dumb one. There's one who's the tough guy who's the bully. And it's just like a really strange, cliche. You know, it was sort of, I was watching it at times, it was almost like corny in some of the things that it does. But the things that it does really, really well make it worthwhile. I mean, basically, Andrew Garfield's, you know, great in it. You really sort of feel for his character. And when the scene shifts into the war mode, when it actually goes into battle, I won't say it's exactly like Saving Private Ryan, but it hits you. You're thrown, when the battle starts, it's basically sort of in this battle. And when the battle starts and there's explosions and people are basically getting killed and everywhere around him. And it's just really, really intense to the extent where it's not like an exciting action scene. It's one of those scenes where you basically, you want it to be over because you feel like you're sort of part of it. You know, there's explosions like, I don't know how they did this, but the explosions just sounded louder than anything I've actually heard in a cinema. They were just constant, you know, bang, bang, bang. It was, you know, and it's, like I say, I won't say it's exactly like Saving Private Ryan because it's a lot more stylized. There's a lot more action scenes in there, whereas Private Ryan was based pretty much on brutality. But it really gets to you. You know, the action scenes are just, you know, absolutely sort of, you know, really in your face and really intense. But it is a really, really sort of incredibly sort of, you know, moving film about this guy who, you know, and the heroics that he actually, you know, does when he's on the battlefield, the amount of people's lives who he saves. And it's a really, really great money. But like I said, you know, in places, you know, just very strangely old fashioned, you know, it was just sort of wasn't quite what I was expecting in that way. You know, there's a lot of sort of scenes that were sort of like, you know, when they charge off into battle with stirring music and everything, which are almost sort of, like I say, corny. But, you know, overall, it is a really, really, you know, great inspiring movie, and it's one of those films that basically sort of, you know, highlights that, you know, this sort of, you know, the work of sort of like, you know, people who were medics in there, you know, what they actually had, you know, had to do.
Yeah, but this was interesting because we've seen that before, and I guess it would be in war movies. You mean it tends to gravitate towards women, but this one specifically had a message of he didn't want to be a soldier that fired a gun. He wanted to just basically be the medic. So it did have an interesting twist on that usual story that we've seen before with the war medic. So I found that to be an interesting premise.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was Hacksaw Ridge. And what was the other movie you said you saw?
Okay, there's two other movies. I went to see Loving. Mm-hmm. And this one is not being nominated for best film, but the actress in it, Ruth Negga, she's been nominated for best actress. And this was a real good film as well. It's basically it stars Ruth Negga and Joel Edgerton, and it's basically the story of, and it's again a true story, and this one is set in Louisiana, where there's basically a mixed race couple who basically go out of state to Washington to get married, because in Louisiana mixed race marriages at that time were not recognized by the state, and were actually illegal. So they come back to the county and they basically sort of live together and as man and wife, and they ended up getting arrested and thrown in jail and driven before the courts because their marriage was deemed to be illegal, and them living together as a couple was basically illegal. So they have to end up basically leave the state because they are basically, as at the end of the trial, they were basically sort of deemed that they were not allowed to be in the state of Louisiana together at the same time. However, they basically, you know, wanted to basically, you know, live, you know, they felt that that's where they belonged, so they would sort of come back, see the family and that sort of thing. And it was a really poignant story. It was very understated as well, which what really impressed me, because when it was a subject like this, there is a tendency to sort of make it into like a melodramatic element where you've got like sort of, you know, lots and lots of sort of big, you know, stirring speeches and people sort of expressing their love for each other and stuff like that. And this wasn't like that at all. They were basically came across as a very sort of natural, quiet couple who were, but at the same time, they managed to sort of, and at times there's lots of scenes in this where there's hardly any dialogue or talking between them at all. But there's this sort of, this chemistry between them, but you really sort of get a sense of the fact that these couple are sort of really, really in love. And basically all, everything that they're going through is in their sort of their mannerisms. And it's just an amazing, understated story. It was just sort of so, you know, well done. And these were just two people just basically just wanted to live together as man and wife. And like I said, it wasn't, you know, it was a very dramatic film, but it wasn't sort of over exaggerated or dramatized in any way. I really, really, really liked it. It's one of those films where you kind of have to be in the mood for, and you have to sort of know, you know, but it's not a sort of, you know, a big sort of film where you've got lots and lots happening all the time. Even the sort of the court case that they're actually involved in to basically sort of, you know, to appeal to basically be allowed to live there. They don't sort of like go to the hearings or anything like that. It's, you know, they're basically, it's in, you know, because they're just not that sort of people. But it's a, you know, it was a really, really, you know, tender, you know, really, really great film. And I really, really enjoyed it. And it's sort of, it's kind of one of those films that is kind of frightening. When you sort of, you know, the stuff that they had to go through just to sort of, you know, live together. And the fact that it was only in the end of the 60s that this was actually going on. You know, it's just, it's not that, you know, when you think about something like that, you sort of think, you know, think about it from like being the turn of like the 20th century. And no, this was nearer the millennium than it was to the second World War. It's, you know, it's quite frightening in you know, that thing. But yeah, you know, it's a really, really important film. But like I said, just really well handled. Just, you know, one of those films that was just sort of had a really, you know, soft touch. He just, you know, the director, Jeff Nichols, just managed to get it just right. So, you know, he wasn't a over the top melodramatic film. It was just like, you know, you really sort of related to these people, you know, as just genuine people.
Yep. And your last movie, Nazza?
The last movie was probably my favorite of the three, because it was just sort of, it was a really powerful film, but really, really entertaining at the same time. And it was it's actually a preview showing I got to go, because it's not out in this country yet.
Really?
I believe I got a the benefits of my cinema pass is sometimes I get to see special preview showings. This was a film called Hidden Figures.
Yeah, because that movie came out a while ago now over here.
Yeah, well, this often happens in the UK when it comes to the Oscar type films, is that they come out very, very late over here. You know, I don't particularly know why that is. I mean, Fences, for example, I believe has come out in America last week, and that one's not due out for another few weeks here. For some reason, the Oscar, you know, nominated films, they also seem to come out quite a bit later. I don't know if it's that they're waiting, because I think I think one of the things I think how I understand it is for them to qualify for the Oscars, they have to be released in the America before a certain time. I think it's before the end of November or December. And so basically, obviously, we need to get them out over here, but they sort of probably just wait a few months later for the UK, you know, for the Europe market. But yeah, anyway, this was a real good film. It's all about three black women who basically work for the NASA space program. One is a mathematician, one is a computer operator, and another one is an engineer. And it's basically about their story and their sort of, you know, having to basically overcome the prejudice of society and basically sort of and gain acceptance and everything, and they're basically sort of, you know, working on the first launches into space of NASA, really, really great film. I mean, it made you really feel for the characters. But also, what was really good about this one is it was a really important subject, but it was also really, really entertaining. There was a lot of banter between the three characters. There were a lot of really funny moments and everything. And it was, you know, there was a mix of sort of like, you know, really sort of, you know, moments where we sort of really felt for the characters. I mean, there's one scene where the lady who's a mathematician, she basically gets put in with the sort of like the think tank, which is basically to, you know, work at the very top of NASA and trying to overcome all the problems. And on the second day, the first day she comes and she drinks from like the coffee pot. And everyone looks at it. And then the next day when she comes in, she sees that they've actually got a coffee pot separate for her to use, you know. And it's one of those scenes that it just like really sort of, you know, hits you in the gut. And, but like I said, there's also sort of like, you know, lots of, you know, really funny bits as well. And just a really, really, you know, great all round movie. There were some bits where I kind of thought they sort of, And maybe it was like, I'm sure like this at the time, but it seemed to be that every time these women walked into a room, all the white people were all like, you know, aghast that there was like a black woman in the room and like uncomfortable. And maybe it was like that, but you know, it's at the same time, it's like, surely there must have been some white people at sort of NASA who were basically not freaking out every time a black woman came into the room. You know, it just felt, but, you know, at the same time, you know, that's the story that they were sort of, you know, telling. And it did sort of build. So, you know, so when, like, for example, the mathematician, when she finally basically had enough of being, you know, treated that way, she basically sort of yelled back at them, you really sort of wanted to cheer, you know. But this was a overall sort of the three, this was my favorite movie. And this is, This one could be the one of the sleepers, you know, just of sort of, you know, for the Oscars. So everyone's looking at La La Land, and everything as being the one that's sort of, you know, be assuring. This is one that I think has got a lot of elements that might surprise, you know, because it is a really, really entertaining film. It's a feel good film. It's, you know, it's popular with audience and everything, but it is of a really, really important subject. And it just sort of, you know, because of the sort of like the environment that we've got at the moment, and also sort of following, let's face it, after last year with where there was all the controversy with Oscars So White and everything, and let's face it, there is a lot of politics that comes into play at times with these sort of films, you know, what gets chosen. It wouldn't surprise me if this was basically to do really, really well and maybe get the Oscar. That's my tape.
For those of you who are in certain betting circles, if you have an Oscar pool, there's your tip. If you'd be so gracious to at least give us, you know, maybe a siphon of that, maybe.
Yeah. No one's gonna get... I have to say, I think there's two, I've not seen Fences yet, and I've not seen Spotlight yet, and I'm hearing a lot of good things about Fences. That seems to have got a lot of vibe and momentum. So maybe that was. But of the films that I've seen, I've loved all the films I've seen, which are Oscar nominated. La La Land, you know, especially Hell or High Water, I love. But I don't know. I just think this one's got just a lot of elements that might win it.
There you go. All right, so those are Dad's Oscar picks. Since we're talking about films that, in some instances, that haven't even made their way to the Dad's side of the pond yet, let's talk about films that no one's seen yet, and let's talk about the trailers that were on last week's Super Bowl show. I guess, sorry, the verbiage was lost on me. But yes, let's talk about all the trailers that were aired during the Super Bowl. Dazza, okay, let's open, because let's open with Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, I mean, all these, by the way, $5 million a pop to get these things on the thing. That's a lot of money. But, you know, I don't know how we get that back. But anyway,
I guarantee you they do, especially when we look at, especially most of these films. You talk about the box office they get, and maybe not all of them will get that money back. Most of them will.
Oh, we'll get it back. I just don't know if they'll actually, if what the sort of the pay. I personally think that this is kind of more of a vanity thing as opposed to a sort of like, you know, that this is going to turn people into ticket buyers of these films. Because by the time these films come out, everyone's going to know about them, you know, but it's, to me, it's kind of like a vanity thing. But anyway, it's a big thing now and you know, the Super Bowl trailer. So yeah, Pirates of the Caribbean was the first one. And, this looked good. You know, the special effects and everything looked impressive and it looked sort of spectacular, but it was everything we've seen before from all the other Pirates of the Caribbean films. In fact, it's almost going back to the first one because it was all the ghost, pirates and, you know, the people who've been missing from the, who were missing the last film are in this one. And it was fine. It just sort of, when I watched it, there was just nothing. Apart from the fact that it looked good, sort of impressively, special effect wise, it just kind of looked like it was just sort of everything we've seen before from these movies. You know, there was nothing, you know, I mean, I personally loved the first Caribbean movie. The next two I found really slow and you know, quite sort of tedious. Apart from the big battle at the end of the third one, I think was like, well, you know, was really entertaining, really great done. But, and the fourth one I just think was awful. I mean, how you can have Ian McShane as Blackbeard in a film and it not be good. God knows how you get that wrong. But yeah, there's also Johnny Depp picked up at the end and, I don't know where it's this has come about, but Johnny Depp used to be somebody that when he would appear, it'd be like, a sense of excitement saying, so, you know, but, you know, something awesome is, it's Johnny Depp. We're going to get like a really good character here. And now Johnny Depp's got this thing that when he appears in films, it's kind of like a groan. You know, when you see him, if he gets cast in something, when he showed up in the Harry Potter film, it's almost like, Johnny Depp. He's really seemed to like burnt through all his, goodwill with audiences, I feel. But yeah, this was okay, but it was nothing that I was sort of like really excited for.
The days of Johnny Depp being a young adult heartthrob, now he's just an old man and it's kind of sad. Maybe he's one of these people that'll age with it, because I noticed Leonardo DiCaprio, obviously he was someone that was, you know, as he was still pretty young when he was pretty much a heartthrob, but he sort of, He's managed to hold on to that, whereas Johnny Depp's is not aging particularly well.
I think he's basically chosen some really, really bad films.
That's some of it too. What was the one that pretty much started this trend? It was the Lone Ranger.
Lone Ranger, yeah. And that was one, when you saw, at that time, when you saw there's going to be a Lone Ranger film and Johnny Depp's going to be Tonto, it was like, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
You know, because he's sort of like, he's always like a really good character in films, you know, and, you know, Tonto's like kind of like, you know, there's going to be lots of really sort of like, you know, opportunity for like some really good stuff here. And it wasn't. And I think that sort of seemed to be from that point onward, he's just sort of like, he went back to the fourth Caribbean movie and that wasn't very good. Was that film that basically just came and disappeared, that Mordecai. That was like, real bad.
Oh, everyone could have told you that was going to be an abomination. Yeah, that looked pretty bad.
Yeah, I started watching that on Netflix and I got into about 5 minutes and I just had to turn it off because it was just so annoying.
It looks like a parody of a Wes Anderson film, and without understanding why a Wes Anderson film is good, it's like, oh, we'll just have Advent over the top characters, and it's like, okay. I realize Wes Anderson movies have those kind of characters in it, and that's sort of the appeal, but that's not the, it's like you still need good writing on top of it and a good story. You can't just have these wild, out of the ordinary characters, and it's like, okay, there's your movie. It's like, no, we need a little bit more.
And those novels that film is based on, those are really good novels. You know, the character in it is kind of a bit of a scoundrel, sort of, you know, and they're sort of really like, you know, good stories, really funny, really well written. And it was just so over the top. His performance was just so annoying. You know, you just couldn't bear it. It was, you know, it's just absolutely dreadful. But yeah, he's made some bad choices.
Yes. All right.
Hitting his wife wasn't a good choice either.
Allegedly. Allegedly.
Okay, allegedly.
Hey, you want to pay for the lawsuit? Be my guest, Azza.
Okay.
Gotta cover your butt here. We have to be, we're in the ever, I don't know how things are over there in your side of the world, Dazza, but over here we are quite litigious. So you always have to cover your butt. You can, Dazza, here's the rule. You can say whatever you want, just follow it with allegedly.
Okay. So I can say anything I want, and it's allegedly?
Yeah. Why, you want to test the water?
Yeah, I'll come up with some stuff.
All right. Let's move on to speaking of questionable decisions. Let's talk Fast and Furious, Dazza, or the fate of the Fast and the Furious.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with this trailer is that the previous trailer was so awesomely over the top and, like, you know, just sort of like, you know, incredible. But this one's kind of just like a bit of, you know, more of the same. You know, it was just sort of, except this one sort of like, you know, had a lot more of sort of Danny Trejo being a, Danny Trejo? Where did that come from?
Wow.
Whoa.
Is it that late over there, Dazza?
Yeah, I've been, this is my first, I've been working for a five day stretch, so I'm really out of it.
It's fine. Take a breath, Dazza.
Yeah, take a breath. Okay. Yeah. So Vin Diesel, I should say, there was a lot more of him as being a bad guy and everything and that, and sort of a lot more of Jason Statham and The Rock having to work together. But it was, I mean, I personally really, really, you know, enjoy these movies. And so I sort of got a kick of all the stunts out of this. But once you've seen a nuclear submarine pop out the ice and sort of and start chasing a load of sort of Lamborghinis or whatever make a car they were down the, on a sheet of ice, you know, you've kind of, there's not much more you can actually sort of like put into a trailer to sort of like, you know, to, for the wow factor. Although the bit with the wrecking ball, smashing into a load of cars, that was pretty outstanding.
See, the problem with this is they're actually, and I'm sure this is going to happen in the film now, considering all the stuff they've done in this film. They're essentially jumping the shark, am I right? Like, how do they go back to making regular Fast and the Furious films after this one? This is sort of the Schumacher version of the Fast and the Furious, where sort of, we were talking about Johnny Depp earlier, where he sort of become a parody of himself. That's what I feel like the Fast and this new Fast and Furious film is. And I would not in the least bit be surprised if they do the literal thing and they have one of the cars jump a literal shark.
Yeah. Yeah. Think about it though. There's always outer space. That's what the Sharknado films did. They went into outer space.
Yeah, when in doubt, right? And then the hood.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Are you familiar with that, Dazza?
What's that?
The Leprechaun movies?
Oh, yes.
They stuck them into space and then they put them in the hood. Oh, God. All right. How do we go from this to talking about, let's talk Transformers. As long as we're talking about fast cars, let's keep that discussion going. Let's talk Transformers, Dazza.
I actually thought this was a really good trailer. Mm. But this is, and it had over sort of, it just had over sort of like really, really cinematic, qualities that the Transformers trailers have. And it sort of like, you know, showed you a sort of sneak of something that might be unicorns sticking out of the ground. And so bits of sort of, you know, lots of explosions, lots of slow-mo and everything, sort of epic thing. And you also had the Optimus Prime sort of like being possessed by something and fighting Bumblebee. The Transformer movies have always done really, really good trailers. And that's probably why I've always been a sucker and gone back to them, even though I know that I basically, you know, I was sort of thinking, this time it's going to be different. This time I'm not being enticed. I'm not going back to watch this film unless there's some like really, really good feedback from
you
people
who
watch
those. Say that, Dazza, but it's, I know it's going to happen. I've said that myself. You'll be bored. You'll have nothing to do on a given evening, and with you, especially with your movie pass, you'll be like, oh God, I guess I might as well go watch it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is about this one, this trailer, we still haven't seen Hitler. We've still not seen King Arthur. We've still not seen the all the time travel stuff. But like I said, you know, the trailer's great, but I think all the trailers have been great with the Transformer movies. It's just that when you actually sort of go and see the film and sort of like, you actually see it, try and see, you know, you see a trailer and you see like Optimus Prime riding down the bridge, riding Grimlock with all the other Dinobots all around him, sort of causing mayhem. And you think, this is so easy. How can this not be fun? And then you go and see it, and it's like one of the worst films you've ever seen. The trailer is sort of 10 out of 10 for sort of like, you know, being a good trailer, but I'll bet the film will be like 1, but we'll see. But it's, you know, but as a trailer, this sort of, you know, did the job.
I guess that's a so as long as we're talking about things, we're talking about things that may have us outwore their welcome or old people. Let's talk John Wick.
I actually like this trip. I'm really looking forward to seeing this. I love the first film. I thought it was awesome, and I really want to see the second one. I actually really like this trailer because they did something a little bit different. We put in a little bit of humor. You know, they sort of like played off the 50 Shades of Grey and did a little bit of a spoof of that. Mm-hmm. And they've not shown a great deal from this movie, but it was like a really, you know, fast paced action packed trailer. I really, really like the first one, and I'm looking forward to this. So for me, this one did the job. But like I say, the fact that they sort of they did a bit of a spoof and had a little bit of a fun with this. You know, that I really, really like. You know, they did something a little bit different.
Okay. From there, we're talking about one old man. Let's talk another. No, I'm kidding. Let's talk Baywatch. Something that used to have an old man in it. And for judging from the dude trailers, it no longer does. Or at least not in the main cast.
Yeah, I mean, it started to get a bit of a cliche where they sort of take in these 80s. Really well-liked 70s and 80s film, and then sort of bringing them back and basically just making them into like, not quite spoofs, but just basically sort of making them into comedy movies. But I gotta say, watching this, everything I've seen so far from this is, you know, as this might be sort of like, you know, really funny and entertaining. I mean, The Rock and Zac Efron, but they seem like a really good double act. And The Rock's one of these people that, he manages to bring his personality, he's brought his personality from wrestling into movies. And he's got, you know, basically what he sort of lacks as a great actor, he makes up for in his charisma. And, you know, the thing that's really surprised me is how good he's been in the comedy stuff. You know, the films where he's done comedy and that, you know, he's sort of, and again, we had that here, but you know, it was playing around with all the Baywatch stuff, and also it's been making fun of the fact that when they see like, you know, one of the women running and saying, "Is it me or she?" You know, running in slow motion. Mm-hmm. So they're having fun with the sort of like the stuff from Baywatch and everything like that, and it's kind of like a homage, but making fun in a sort of. In a nice way, and not a really sort of like, you know, real sort of, you know, like the 21 Jump Street thing. They sort of, you know, they made fun of the concept, but sort of like, you know, in lovingly or so. But yeah, I think this one, I'm going to go see it, you know, and I hope it for like, you know, some like, you know, really fun stuff in there. But yeah, everything when I first heard they were making this, I thought that this was going to be like absolutely awful. And everything I've actually seen from this so far, it just looks like it's going to be a good laugh.
There you go. I'm curious that you brought up The Rock, and he's obviously become one of the biggest, if not the biggest, box office attractions in cinema today. I wonder, the thing is, you often see this with a lot of actors. They'll become the big box office sensation, and eventually they get bored with that, so the next challenge becomes, can they win an Oscar? Do you think Rock's ever going to go through that phase? Do you think he's talented enough to go through that phase? Do you think there's going to be that role out there for him that really does push him over the top, that puts him in that Oscar contention? Or is he just going to be one of these people that is content making the big blockbuster? Because the one I'm thinking of right now specifically, I was trying to think of a specific example, and I really couldn't think of one until I thought of Will Smith. Will Smith was a guy who made tons of money in the 90s with the big action movies, and then eventually he dipped his toes and tried to get nominated for Oscars. I'm wondering, is The Rock ever going to have that phase, or is he just going to be content making the big budget action and comedy movies?
I would be surprised if he sort of, if he tried something like that at some point. You know, if he sort of went for like a, you know, because he's in this position now where he's probably made more money than he can ever sort of, you know, that he, you know, I mean, everyone can spend the money, let's face it. But I think he's sort of set for life, and he's sort of like, you know, he's in all these franchises. So it looks like he's going to be in the DC, universe, although, you know, that changes on like, you know, from a week to week basis these days. You know, he's going to be a Black Adam, which apparently we're sort of talking that maybe that will be a Black Adam film before there's a Shazam film, if you can believe that. Mm-hmm. So he's in all these different franchises. So it would have surprised me at some point if he basically sort of like, you know, goes for, you know, takes a chance and goes for something a bit meatier. And just because we've sort of not seen it from him before, I mean, who would have thought that Will Smith, seeing him in like the, you know, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, that one day he'd be, you know, in sort of like, you know, Oscar nominated films and in Oscar nominated roles. So, you know, I'm not saying that it'd be a success, but I can imagine that at some point, because one of these things that drives people like him at times is doing something, you know, is basically challenges. And it would not surprise me if he sort of, you know, go for it. And let's face it, there's a lot of, you know, people who would absolutely, you know, love to work with him. You know, and so to, you know, give him that opportunity. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if he did. I mean, the guy that springs to mind for me is Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's another one. That's another guy who made tons of movies, making, you know, action movies, making comedy movies in the 90s, and then eventually he dipped his toes into the water to try to be taken seriously as an actor.
Yeah, and what was the film he did? Split my mind.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Yeah, that one, but also The Truman Show.
Yeah.
Which, where he managed to sort of like, you know, bring it into like the comedy elements, but also, you know, really show his range and, you know, make it into a really heartfelt movie. So that's another one who basically, and at that time, he was being typecast in all his films were basically the variations of Ace Ventura. Mm-hmm. And it was just eventually, I actually remember him. I think it was after he did the Batman movie. Where he was doing an interview and he was sort of just saying them there, like, you know, that he, you know, someone out there, I can do other stuff apart from sort of the big zany over the top characters. He actually said this to the camera and he said, you know, someone give me a shot just to sort of do something with a bit of emotion and everything. And they did, you know, and he pulled it off great. So, you know, who's to say if a Rock, you know, Give him the right guy to work with. And the one thing about him is that he does come across as somebody who works massively, massively hard at his craft. Because most wrestlers, like, you know, who basically got into acting, you know, none of them sort of like were massive success, but they all sort of stuck to a sort of a certain type of film. Whereas he basically sort of, you know, he tried to basically sort of, you know, do comedy and act as well as action and stuff. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he sort of gets a shot at something else.
Yeah, another actor that does that. I mean, obviously to a lesser degree, but you'll still see this from her, from Scarlett Johansson. She'll do the serious roles and the movies that she's more concerned with. You know, how is her performance? And it's basically the I guess you would say the showcase film for the performances. And then you have something she's also being attached to. Another thing we saw a trailer for was Ghost in Shell. Obviously, this is something that, it's not really going to highlight her acting ability, but still, it's still a bit of a cash grab. The idea that you could still bounce back and forth and do both. So, I'm curious what you thought of the Ghost in Shell trailer.
This was the first trailer that I saw that I actually started to sort of look forward to this movie. Mm. You know, it just sort of, I just sort of, you know, like the look of it and everything. I've got to say, this was never one of my favorite animes. I'll probably have to rewatch it again at some point because it's a long time since I saw it, but it was one that I was watching a lot of anime at the time, and this one, it didn't really stand out, you know, much for me aside from, you know, a lot of the other stuff I was watching at the time. So, you know, but this one, you know, it looks, you know, it looks great. It looks, you know, it sort of you know, some of the scenes in there look sort of like, you know, really, really impressive reaction scenes and everything. I think that the only thing that sort of gets me about this film is it, and it, and it's not like it at all, but it comes across when you're watching these trailers. It, it looks almost like the film Lucy and what she did in there with Sophie, which is unfair because it's not, but that seems to be how it's sort of been marketed a little bit. Mm. But generally speaking, I'm starting to look forward to this film, and it's been a slow burn with me because it's not one that I've been really, really massively excited for, but it looks good and everything. And so we'll see.
All right. Yeah. I'm sort of there with, there was that controversy when they first cast her. It's like, oh, you're going to have a white woman in the role of this anime character, but you know, my co-host from Comic Conversations here, also here at halfguard.com, also was quick to point out, yeah, it's an anime, but even if you watch the anime itself, the character in that role is in fact a white woman. So the idea that you're getting up in arms because it's not an Asian character, it's like, okay, then you clearly haven't seen the anime then, so you can't sit there and complain. Okay, another trailer we saw, something that Scarlett's also attached to was, not directly, but part of the franchise, would it be another entry from the Marvel films? We had the new Guardians of the Galaxy trailer.
Yeah, I mean, this one looks so much fun. It's sort of, they really sort of get everything right with this movie. Basically, the first one works so well, and they're not changing. You know, obviously, I'm sure the story is going to change and everything, but this one, they're basically just sort of, they're sticking to what made the first film such a great success. You know, with lots of humor, you know, lots of, you know, Batista gets, you know, he seems to have become the guy in these films. You know, when these films first came around, everything was about Rocket. And now, if you notice, all of these trailers, they always end with a moment from Batista, Dave Batista. You know, they have that trailer where he basically, where Star-Lord's sort of secret gets revealed, and he's sort of like, he's laughing at him and saying, oh, you must be so embarrassed and everything. And then in this one, it sort of ended where the girl gets hit by some sort of like meteor blast or something. And afterwards he says, look out. And then he goes, I tried. And he just, he seems to basically sort of really sort of become like, you know, the one who has the funny lines in these films, you know, the one who you're waiting for to see what he's going to see next. And it's just, I just think that's amazing because of all the people, he's kind of the one that you wouldn't really have expected to basically sort of shine in this film, but he has. You know, but again, this trailer had everything. It sort of got the sort of, you know, the 70s soundtrack and everything, and just sort of, you know, Baby Groot. And we saw a lot more of Landau in this one, which was you've not seen that much of in the other ones, but he seemed to be the Guardians themselves. It has expanded the roster and everything. So, what's interesting as well about this is that everything's all on the Guardians. You actually know nothing about what the story is in this film yet.
No,
and I'm fine with that. You know, you've not even seen like who the, you've seen lots of sort of battle scenes, but you've not really seen who they're actually fighting. Because basically the big thing that people want to see is the Guardians. And to me, I would, for a change, I would be quite happy going into a cinema and not really sort of knowing what the actual storyline is. Mm-hmm. And when I think about it, when I actually went to see the first Guardians of the Galaxy film, I don't think then that I knew at all what the story actually was going to be, what the main threat was. I don't even know if I knew who the villain was in the first film when I went to see it. So it was a totally blank thing for me. And to be honest, you know, in a film like this, all you need to know is that you've got the characters, it's going to be fun, it's going to be loud, and you're going to have a great soundtrack. And to me, that's all you need to know. I honestly don't care if I don't see any other villains or anything like that, because it'll be nice going to see everything fresh.
Well, see, remember, I was the one that was saying, it's like, okay, you can make a first movie because you have to introduce all these characters and you can have an origin where they're all being put together. But then after a while, it's like, what stories do you tell? And that's easier said than done. That's why I think everyone's going to like this movie. Everyone's going to watch the second one, but people are going to be, I guess, to a degree lacking. I don't think we're going to get a third film. I just don't think there's enough there in the tank to garner a third film. But that's just my personal opinion. And have you seen, I think someone I guess the who was in charge of all the Marvel films? Am I pronouncing that name?
Kevin Feige.
Yeah, Feige. I guess someone came to him with a complaint about the Marvel films as of late. How there's no, aside from Loki, most of the villains seem to be particularly lacking. And the idea that you don't even know who the villain in this film is. I've heard it's going to be that Mantis woman that they've shown in the trailer. That's what I've heard so far. I don't know. If
really?
That's what I've heard. Yeah, I know. That doesn't okay. help the criticism of them having really weak antagonists, but it would not shock me. This is one of those things to where I've seen it on the internet, but as always, Daz, you always have to take it with a grain of salt. You don't know how much truth there is behind it. You don't know if this is a bogus report or they're just trying to get this new character over. You have to take it with obviously a grain of salt, but that's what I've heard. That's what I've seen. And if that's the way they're going to go, it's like, oh, because that's the thing with the Guardians as well. It's like, well, when you think about all the cool Marvel space villains, it's like they're all attached to different franchises. So it's really hard to do something and get people to care about. It's like, oh, I mean, you can't really do Surfer and Galactus, and you can't really do, I'm trying to think what other characters you could do. Terrax, or you can't, eventually they're going to want to pull the trigger on Thanos, but I don't think they're going to do it in this film. So there's not much to go from. Actually, you know what? It actually be a really good one, but it also may be attached to the Fantastic Four franchise. Annihilus. But I'm pretty sure that's also tied up with the Fantastic Four franchise.
I mean, sometimes it's quite surprising who is actually who has who, but I would have thought that Annihilus would have actually come with the Fantastic Four. Cause it was sort of like, you know, it's sort of like really, you know, linked in with that, you know, quite a lot. So I would have thought that they would have Annihilus. Cause I know they had, the big planet guy, what was his name? Who actually does featuring in Eagle. Galaxy. Yeah, he was actually, the Fantastic Four franchise had him. But the Fox did a deal, with Marvel. If Marvel could have him back so that they could basically change, teenage Megasonic's powers. Did you see that story?
I have not, but that is cool. That is cool. No, I was not aware of that.
Yeah. Basically, they wanted to change her power set, for the Deadpool movie. And to get permission, and they asked Marvel for permission to do that. So, which was quite, newsworthy, because it basically showed for the first time that Marvel, even though that Fox have the rights to these characters, Marvel still have some say how they're used. Mm-hmm. So they had to go to Marvel and sort of say, you know, can we change the power thing? And they sort of did the deal that if they could have that character back, that they could basically sort of do what they want with, Teenage Sonic, Megasonic. I always forget what her name is. Mm-hmm. Teenage Megasonic. Yeah, you know what she is.
The Grant Morrison character.
So
yeah.
Basically, so it's interesting because Marvel still have some sort of like, you know, links, you know, some rights to the characters that they can, you know, so Fox can't basically just sort of say, you know, we're going to have, you know, Wolverine turn green and, you know, have, sort of claws, you know, shooting out his feet and everything like that. And he's going to sort of shoot fireball. You know, they can't basically change those characters too much. They have to basically sort of, there's only, you know, there are some parameters that they have to basically keep in line with the sort of, you know, with the actual source, which I found interesting.
Yes. The one thing I'm curious, this could all be remedied if they keep Thanos the way he is in the comic books. But I feel like they're gonna feel the need to go in the traditional route where he's just the generic villain. He's just the dark side. He's just a one dimensional character that's just super evil. Cause to me, that's why I like the Thanos character, cause he's so relatable. Cause he's a guy who's, I guess, sorta evil, but really at the end of the day, the reason why he's doing all these things is just because he wants to impress death. And I think that's a really relatable, like the idea that he's pining over this girl that's never really going to be into him, and they're sort of just stringing him along. It's like, that's super relatable. It's like, if they keep that and they want sort of a villain with three dimensions, I think that'd be the best way to go. Cause aside from Loki, really, most of their villains have been pretty, you know, one dimensional. Obviously, the thing is with these films is you're always going to want to have your superheroes be more, I guess, fully dimensional characters, but at the same time, when you have these characters where just cardboard cutouts, it's like, you can have three-dimensional villains that are quasi-interesting without taking the focus off the superhero, so.
The thing is, if they'd have actually sort of had some like really, really, you know, great villains along the way, they could have built it where eventually you'd have sort of like a team up of villains.
Yeah, but at this point, like,
now you sort of, you know, they're sort of, they've done such a poor job that that's not going to mean anything. But if they'd have actually sort of worked to sort of do some really good stuff with the villains, you know, eventually down, you know, if they'd have sort of had like a really, really cool Red Skull, well, I suppose Red Skull was okay, you know, have him sort of team with Loki and Thanos and stuff. But, you know, they're basically just sort of like, done such a poor job of that, but that's not gonna, you know, mean anything.
Or Zemo and the Masters of Evil, that could have been something cool that they'd done.
But, yeah.
You know, we see what they've done with Zemo. He's just an angry Eastern European dude. It's like, okay, that's not nearly as interesting. I mean, I obviously know where they're coming from. They want their movies to be more grounded and more realistic, but at the same time, it's like, okay, you had an opportunity to do something with Zemo and he's just a dude.
Well, look what we did with the Mandarin.
Huh?
Oh, look what God. We did with the Mandarin. If you watch the little video clip that shows up on one of the Blu-rays, the little short film, it turns out that when he's in jail, he finds out that there's a hint that there actually is a real Mandarin out there.
Yeah, I heard about that. I haven't seen it myself, but I have in fact heard this. It's almost like they're doing it service to people that read comic books, because it's like, yeah, we know, we sort of screwed up the Mandarin, we sort of made him this hodgepodge of characters and justifications. It's like, okay, you made a bit of a joke, but they did some damage control, but still, it's like, no, it's like, you stopped the bleeding, but it's still pretty bad.
Yeah.
All right, our final trailer that we're going to talk about from the Super Bowl show, Logan.
Yeah, I mean this one was okay, but it to be honest, it was pretty much everything we've seen already. It was just just with a new soundtrack, and it was kind of cool, you know. It was nice, but from everything that we've seen, this really didn't add anything more to it. I think there was a shot of Caliban. And stuff that you said, if you watch closely enough, but generally speaking, it was a good trailer, and it was like a final, we're almost there sort of feel to it, you know, but there was nothing sort of new. But to be honest, again, I feel like I've already seen enough of what I want to see. I don't want to see anything more. I don't want to sort of, what they did with X-Men Apocalypse, where they panicked and they basically threw in the little, like, you know, Wolverine cameo into the trailer. If there's any surprises to come, I kind of want to see him in the film now. I just sort of, I'm quite happy with what we've got. But this was okay. It was just like a little reminder, but there was nothing like, was nothing in there that sort of like was anything new or spectacular or anything. By the way, have you seen the trailer? One of the newer trailers that they've done with Patrick Stewart at the end.
Tell me what it is, because I've seen a couple of the trailers that he is in fact in it. I don't know what you're referring to though.
There's one where he's basically him and Logan are in this like hotel room, and Patrick Stewart is like looking really, really exhausted, and he's complaining, and he says, We've been on the road for 9 days, no food, no sleep. And he goes, she's 6 years old and I'm fucking 90.
I think I may have seen maybe just once, yeah. But I don't know. I do know what you're talking about here.
Yeah. I saw that for the first time in the cinema and I absolutely cracked up because it was sort of the way Patrick Stewart was talking. I thought he's going to deliver something here. But when he sort of like just said that, but Professor Xavier basically sort of complaining about being fucking 90, that just tickled my funny bone.
All right, that's gonna do it for the Super Bowl trailer discussion. Let's move on to we've played a little bit with the structure here, but let's move on to, I guess, what people would expect the I guess what would the term for be something like this, Dazza? The bedrock? I don't know. The one of the features that we've always done, and we're always gonna continue to do. But let's talk rate and slate. What's that?
The focus.
There we go. The focus of this. Oh, benchmark. That's a radio term, Dazza, when you're talking about a recurring bit.
Oh, okay.
There you go. That's your radio lesson of the day. All right, let's move on to rate and slate. Now, obviously, we've gone from the 70s. We've gone, thanks to our friends at TKO170.com, we have 2007's top 10 box office receipts recipients. And let's start at number 10, Dazzle, with The Bourne Ultimatum. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Number 9, National Treasure, Book of Secrets. Number 8, The Simpsons Movie. Number 7, I Am Legend. Number 6, Ratatouille. Number 5, Transformers. Number 4, Shrek the Third. Number 3, Spider-Man 3. Number 2, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. And at number 1, Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. I think when it comes to rate, it's going to be a lot harder. But with Slate, really, I feel like you could really just pick any movie. You'd probably be right. All right, Dazzle, what's going to be your rate for 2007? Because there's slim pickings here.
They're very slim pickings. I mean, of this bunch, of the rate I'm going to go for might be a bit of a surprise one, but considering what else there is to go for, it's going to be the Transformers movie.
Really? That one I'm shocked on.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I still think that the first Transformer movies was a fun action blockbuster. That was, you know, I personally, you know, enjoyed it as a movie. I thought that, it was, where this went really well is, the action scenes made sort of sense. There weren't just like lots and lots of sort of explosions and like loads of things going on the screen at once. It was like a flow to the scene, was a flow to the battle. And the fact that they sort of limited how many Transformers there actually were. So I think you only had about like 5 Autobots and about, you know, 6 or 7 Decepticons. So you got a sense of a sort of an actual battle between two gangs, as it was, with the humans in between and everything. And I think basically it was just done really, really sort of well. I actually sort of didn't mind the comedy in it. In fact, a lot of the comedy I actually liked, apart from the Secret Service group, you know, I thought they were that kind of really annoyed me. And there were a few little embarrassing bits, like when Bumblebee sort of leaking lubricant on the guy and stuff. But generally speaking, I thought it sort of, you know, got quite a lot of things right. It sort of, you know, the story was serviceable. It was fine. As a fun blockbuster, I personally sort of really, really liked this one. And I was fine with it. Everything that came after this film was an absolute abomination. You know, in so many things, to this, you know, in fact, that I'm a big Transformers fan. I was waiting for these films for years and years. And at least I got one good film out of them that I really, really enjoyed. After this, everything else was just an absolute sort of really, really badly written, really embarrassingly made, just, you know, really sort of like, you know, incoherent. And also, at least this one, it had a MacGuffin that we were all fighting over, but at least it was like a MacGuffin that was kind of easy to relate to and made sense. When we started doing the things where it was almost like a mysticism to it all, it just sort of, and you had sort of like robot testicles and robots farting and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It just got really, really embarrassing. But this first one, I think for the most part, was a fun over the top movie that they needed to be.
I'm still shocked you went with Transformers, because it's like you could have easily gone and I guess it would be the other two directions. It's like I'm obviously going to do the honorable mention to the Simpsons movie. I really can't speak for the Bourne Ultimatum. I keep saying that wrong. But for me, I gotta go with Ratatouille here. This is the only film that I, you know, very rarely do I, when I go with my rate, it's obviously a film that I particularly like more than the other ones. But for me, I'm gonna have to go objectively here, and it's gonna lead me to the same conclusion anyway. Ratatouille, this is when, I can't believe I'm saying this.
I've never seen it, so, you know.
You're kidding me.
No, I've never seen it.
Is it just for one reason or another, or are you just not a fan of the Pixar films? I'm curious now.
No, it's not that I like the Pixar films. It's just not one that I ever got around to seeing.
Huh. Well, there you go. Something you learn about someone new every day. But speaking of which, we're recording this on Sunday, and after I'm done doing this show, I'm going to go with my friends, and we're going to go to the Largo Theater in Los Angeles, California. We are going to watch the star of this film, Patton Oswalt, do some stand-up. So there you go. There's your connection. But this is the film. Obviously, I'm going to go with it. This is when Pixar, and I can't believe I'm saying this is 2017, when Pixar used to do really good films. It's sad to say. Obviously, you still get instances of here and there, and when they'll make really good movies. But you know, I think with the recent exception being the new Finding Dory film, they've been on a dry spell as far as movies that are particularly good. Especially when you're talking films like, I think it was the second Cars movie, and there's even been trailers for a third Cars movie, and it's just like they don't know enough to leave well alone. Obviously, they make money, but it's like. The thing with them has always been that they're good family films, or I'd say they're really good, even Oscar nominated family films. And lately they've just been like, they seem like cash grabs. And this is still sort of when they found that delicate balance between being a good children's movie, but still something for adults, while still pulling on a traditional family film. But that even if you're not in that inclined, you could still watch this and be like, hey, this is a really good structurally sound film. Especially when you're talking about Oscar contention, usually walks away with the Oscar for best animated film. Cause really, even if you took away the CG itself and just presented it as a normal film, they're still really well written, well directed movies. And I feel like if you took away that element, you could still wind up seeing it on Oscar lists as, you know, best film. So that's why I'm going to have to go with, Ratatouille. Sort of nothing. It's not something I felt passionately about. It's nothing that I'm a big fan of. Obviously, I want to do an honorable mention to The Simpsons. I'm one of these people that still kind of likes the TV show. I still kind of like the movie, but when you're comparing against Ratatouille, there's really no comparison here. I'm going to have to go with Ratatouille. But,
What do you think of Inside Out?
I thought that was fine. It to me, that was like right in the middle. I think that was middle of the road. Like, it wasn't like Cars 2 bad, but at the same time, it wasn't like Toy Story 3 or even Ratatouille. It was just like, okay, it was fine. It was good, but it wasn't great. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
All right. Since we've talked all right. Obviously, we got to mention the bad now. Let's go with Slate, Dazza. And I feel like with this slate of movies, it's really hard to go wrong, but I'm curious to see what direction you wind up going in.
Yeah, I mean, the one I'm gonna go for. I mean, I could go for the Pirates of the Caribbean film, which I mentioned earlier, but the one I'm gonna go for, because it really disappointed me so much, quite such high hopes, so it's Spider-Man 3.
Yep.
This was just a mess of a story, and right from the opening, I just felt it's just something wasn't right about this. One of the things that got me about this film is how much bad writing there was. Because there were so many coincidences. It just, you know, from the fact that this alien, you know, venom that basically sort of crash lands on Earth, just happens to crash in Central Park right next to Spider-Man, you know. And then the guy who basically sort of shot his uncle escapes from jail and basically just happens to get superpowers. and then the guy who he's got a grudge with just happens to basically get infected with the venom virus himself, and the story was just all over the place. You know, it started with Harry Osborn having the fight scene and losing his memory. It just everything about this film, it just sort of really, really, and it should have been great, because it's like, you know, a couple of the standout characters, it's like Venom, who's basically, a great character and then they got the look good, but just, you know, just what they did with it was awful. And Sandman was a bad element in it and everything. Just for the whole, it was just a complete mess. And as for sort of like emo Peter Parker, that was just sort of, you know, that was just sort of annoying. It just everything about it, and that sort of long subplot with Mary Jane, where her acting career is on the brink and everything. It just this entire film, I just remember watching it, and it just went on and on and on, and it was just I think, you know, this one after Spider-Man 2, which they seem to have basically sort of turned things around and sort of come up with like a really, really good thing to do this one. And it's not, everyone sort of goes, oh, well, they had too many villains in there. No, it's not because they had too many villains in there. It's because they basically came up with a really sort of bad story. And it's just absolutely horrible.
Yeah, you mentioned the Mary Jane thing. I remember there was a this was obviously back in 2007, so this was before the age that really YouTube really took off. But I think there was this I think it was Funny or Die. It was one of them. But they have a bit of a parody of like the Spider-Man toys, and they had the Mary Jane toy interacting with the Spider-Man toy. I remember the exact line. They were having the kids play with them, like, oh, Mary Jane subplot. It's like, look. This is Spider-Man 3, not Mary Jane 3. Nobody cares about you.
And the thing is, her character was such a downer in that movie, and she was totally overshadowed by Gwen Stacy. Mm-hmm. You know, I forgot the actress's name, but the one who played Gwen Stacy just came across with so much more presence than her and everything. And it was just the whole film was just a complete washout and just a real disappointment.
Yeah, it's one of these films where I watched it and. Like, I put off watching it because I've heard all the bad things, but I was sort of the opinion of, there's no way it can be this bad. It's like, maybe people are going in with the idea of they wanted a certain something, and it didn't quite live up to their expectations, and they're sort of laying their nitpicks of it take down the movie. So it's one of these films where I heard all the bad things, but I put it off. It's like, okay. What you've told me is sort of taking a lot of wind out of my sails, but I bet if I go up to the cinema and I sit down there and I watch the movie itself, you know what? I bet it's probably going to be fairly decent. And it's like, it was one of those things where I actively wanted to like the film because who doesn't like Spider-Man? But yeah, just, I think it was after like maybe 45 minutes into the film, I was like, wow, I don't know. This film didn't know what story it wanted to tell. This is, I get the feeling, I would like to see, obviously we've heard of the documentary that talks about that Fantastic Four film that was made just so the studio can hold on to the rights. I would love to see a documentary made about Spider-Man 3. Cause obviously you've heard all the stories behind it. Sam Raimi just wanted to go in the direction of the Sandman. Cause he felt like there was a particularly strong story there with Peter. The idea that he was the one that killed his father. And to me, that seemed like the stronger direction. But, you know, the comic book fans, and I was sort of guilty of this, was like, okay, we played nice with you in this first movie, and then the second one we were disappointed when you didn't get Venom. But it's like, okay, you've strung us along for two movies now. We wanted Venom for so long. Can we please have it? And it's one of these things where the studio kind of had to, like, they heard the fans, but Raimi was like, look, you gotta tell a story first, above anything else. And it's like, I have a story here for Sandman, and it's a really meaty story that I feel like could get 120 minutes out of. It's like, oh, but the studios, I get the feeling, cut his legs off and was like, no, this is our film. You're going to put Venom in it because we want it. And it's like one of these things to where it's, and you'll see this, and I still think you get this from, especially now with the DC films, with the news coming up that Ben Affleck is no longer interested in having anything creatively to do with the Batman movie. It's one of these things you'll see from these superhero films because there's so much money involved and there's so many people that want, you know, X, Y, and Z to be from the film. The idea that you have too many chefs in the kitchen, and it's just like, okay, this film, they're trying to please everybody, but in the process, when it finally comes out and the movie going public checks it out, it's like, nobody's happy. Because it's like, it's sort of like, I guess they have to make a coalition. It's like, okay, we put this in there, we'll put this in there, put this in there. And it's like, nobody winds up getting what they like. And the actress you were mentioning earlier was Bryce Dallas Howard.
Okay.
I had to do a double take because I'm like, all those three names, none of them are
none of them match.
I know. Well, it's like, okay, I could see a guy named Bryce Dallas Howard, but a pretty girl, a pretty blonde.
I mean, just going back as well, you mentioned the sort of, you know, the Sandman stuff. Some of the best scenes were the bit where sort of he's going for revenge on Sandman, and he sort of gets him, battles him in the subway, and he's sort of like really going to town him in a way you've not seen him done before. They're probably the best bits in the film, you know, but the other story, you know, the other storylines, none of the stories mix and match in to make a whole. You know, you can have sort of two, I mean, Empire Strikes Back is a really good idea of this, where you've got two completely different stories that basically still manage to come, you know, to be brought together for a purpose to cross over. But in this film, it's just kind of like a bunch of stuff that happens, you know. So, but yeah. Stay, don't bother everyone. Don't bother watching this film.
This is why I tell myself, don't get invested with these superhero movies, because it's one of these things to where they've had to do so much to raise all the money for this film. And usually, you know, people aren't going to just do this out of the kindness of their heart. Obviously, they want to return. But then there's obviously the studio, and they do test marketing. They feel like, oh, if we have X, Y, and Z, the movie will perform better. But then you ultimately get this abomination of just, like, test marketing and people wanting their two cents and the director thinking they know better than the comic book writers. And it's like, okay, then you're just going to ultimately wind up pleasing nobody. All right, we did our rate and slate. We're gonna do the segment I like to do after we go.
Oh, well, what's your slate?
Oh, I'm gonna go with Spider-Man 3 as well. I mentioned.
Oh, you okay. Know, so you're going back. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned. It's like, oh, I wanted the film to be so good. I'm looking at other honorable mentions that I could put on this. I Am Legend, the movie they just the ending they decided to go with in theaters. I thought that was really disappointing. But rest of these films, I don't think I watched. It's funny, a lot of these films, I seem to remember them, like, I remember seeing a lot of these films at the beginning of the year, and then obviously when you talk about Spider-Man 3, I remember seeing that in summer, but then I also remember watching, I guess, late in the summer, watching the Simpsons movie, and then even in the fall, watching, I think, was Ratatouille. So this is a particularly long year for films. I didn't even know most of these films came out the same year. But
yeah. I've got to say the Order of the Phoenix was a really good one, and especially so because that book was one of my least favorites, because it was quite ponderous and stuff, but it really managed to sort of, like, you know, it really did a good job of editing the actual J.K. Rowling story and making it into a coherent narrative. So that one's a pretty of the list, that's a pretty decent film as well.
All right, let's look at the rest of these. This is the thing I like to do. Obviously, we went over the top 10. We did our rating slate from the top 10, but I like to do an honorable mentions. Let's see what else is on this list. Let's see.
Ocean's 13, I absolutely love. That's the third one. It's the one set in Las Vegas.
That's right.
With Robert De Niro. Not Robert De Niro, Al Pacino.
Yeah, I remember seeing the first one. I never got around to watching the other two because I was just like, okay, these are clearly cash grabs. I don't know if they're
the second one is awful. And it's actually, the second one makes no sense whatsoever. It's worth watching and it's quite tedious, but it's worth watching when you afterwards you just go, that, I don't get that. You know, it doesn't, you know, the actual story doesn't work. The third one, I just found loads and loads of fun. You know, the fact that they go back to, I mean, this one's almost like a homage to Las Vegas. And the fact that they go back to Las Vegas to basically take on Al Pacino, and it's sort of like it's a scam caper, but it's also a revenge caper. I personally really enjoy the third one.
Let's see other notables on this list.
American Gangster's good.
Yeah, you stole the words right out of my mouth. There's a lot of stingers. I'm going to come back one year later. Juno. That was a surprise hit. Superbad. That was a great movie.
Nocturne I liked. That's funny.
Where's that on the list?
Nocturne. That's number 22. The Seth Rogen movie.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, I'm familiar with the film, but I don't know how my eyes were glossing over it. Other honorable mentions that came out. This is a wide year of films, because some of these films I thought, you know, these obviously came out in the aughts, but you assume they came out different years, because, you know, if you told me all these films came out the same year, I'd be sort of blown away. No Country for Old Men. That came out in 2007.
Yeah, yeah. Charlie Wilson's War. That's a good one.
And then
it's got the great line in it where one of the women says, he has a saying, you can teach a woman to type, but you can't teach her to have big tits.
I'm going to put that on a shirt. okay, let's. I felt like we went over the good films. Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. That was a stinker. I unfortunately watched in the theaters. What else is really bad here? There's another superhero film that I thought was particularly bad.
Blades of Glory. I
like that film.
I like that film. The bit where they're watching the video of the trick that went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
when it basically decapitates it.
That was great.
That was hilarious.
Oh God! Speaking of bad superhero films, Ghost Rider.
Ugh.
Yeah, the less said about it, the better. I'm looking at this. Yeah, there's a lot of bad films, but some of them I don't even feel are worth talking about. But those are the Predator versus Alien Requiem. It's like, I guess apparently there was a lot of criticism of the first film because it was rated PG-13. You had both franchises which have been rated R, and then the idea that you're going to put them together and it's going to be rated PG-13. So this was sort of the answer to that. But Evan Almighty. I'm surprised. We were talking about Jim Carrey earlier today, and Evan Almighty is so low on the list. Oh, wait, that's because that was the Steve Carell one, right? Never mind. Answer my own question. That's about it. That was 2007 in a nutshell. A wide range of movies, some good, some bad. All right, let's move on to our... Actually, let's... I'm getting
ahead of myself. Oh, God, Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Yes, that's one that...
Anyone who has kids has my sympathy for that film. I went to see Charlie Brown, and they had a trailer for the latest Chipmunks movie. And after 2 minutes of listening to that shrill, bloody voice, I wanted to punch things. If anyone who has kids and had to take their kids to see that piece of shit, you have my sympathies.
All right, Dazza, of all the films we mentioned earlier, we're going to do our regular segment. Of all of the films that came out the year, both good and bad, Dazza, what do you think won Best Picture the year following, 2008?
I'll be honest, the only one I can think of.
You're probably right.
That would be in contention would be No Country for Old Men.
You'd be correct, Daz. Maybe it was a slow year for Oscar worthy films, but yes, the fact that you went straight to there, it's like, that'd be the correct way to go. I'm looking at all these films and some of them are really good, but when I'm thinking of, Oscar worthy, it's like, no, not really. It's not really many directions you can go with.
What else got nominated?
Let me look this up.
Because you've got the list, because I've not.
What I'll usually do is I'll just look up Best Picture, but let me look up the nominations as well while I'm at it.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, let's see. To the 80th Annual Academy Awards. Best Picture nominations, obviously we mentioned the winner, No Country for Old Men, but other notables were Atonement, Juno, Michael Clayton, and There Will Be Blood. I could see maybe going in the direction of There Will Be Blood, but they already gave best actor to Daniel Day-Lewis, and he, as good as that film was, it really is a character movie. So I can see why they decided to go with No Country for Old Men, because that film was sort of an ensemble. There was no real, I guess, focal character. So there you go. All right, let's move on to the 28th annual. I'm sorry, Golden Razzies. Let's go over worst pictures. And as always, you know the gimmick, Dazza. You try to guess which one of these films is the worst of the worst. All right, at number one, Daddy Day Camp. Number two, I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. Number three, I Know Who Killed Me. Number four, Bratz. And at number five, Norbit.
I'm going to go with Daddy Day Camp.
You would be incorrect, Dazza. And if this were up to me, I'd probably go with I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. But no, I Know Who Killed Me won Worst Picture for 2007.
I don't even know about one.
It's that Lindsay Lohan pick, and she also won Worst Actress. It was the film where it was, I think it was the, I forget if she had the two personalities or it was the twins, but where was that murder mystery where she's trying to figure out, let's see, I'm trying to figure this out right now. I Know Who Killed Me. I don't know if it was the twins thing, but it was basically just an opportunity for Lindsay Lohan to make a film where she's a stripper. So it's like, okay.
Oh. I remember the poster. I remember the poster of a video sleeve where she's basically sort of doing like a lap, like a pole dancing scene. So yeah, that bit I remember.
Okay, I'm reading the synopsis of this film where someone attempts to make take her life. She survives, but in surviving, she thinks she's somebody else now. So the idea is she's trying to figure out who tried to kill her, but the idea is I know who killed me. So I guess that's the appeal. And another direction they could have gone with was Norbert. I thought that film was pretty bad. So we've seen the demise of Eddie Murphy, but he won Worst Actor, so I guess that's sort of your compilation prize. Ooh, here's an interesting fact. Nicolas Cage was nominated, but not just for one film, two films, Dazza, for his for National Treasure's Book of Secrets, Ghost Rider, and Next. So, it's a triple threat as far as bad movies. Other notables on this list. Eddie Murphy also won Worst Supporting Actor. And Worst Supporting Actress. Worst Supporting Actor as the character Wong, and Worst Supporting Actress as the character Rasputa in Norbert as well. Oh god, it's the best one. As long as we're talking about people winning multiple awards, Lindsay Lohan and Lindsay Lohan as her yin to her own yang in I Know Who Killed Me for Worst On-Screen Couple. Worst prequel or sequel would go to Daddy Day Camp, Dazza, so you were right on that. But yeah, it pretty much just seemed to be a two-note affair, because every other award either went to I Know Who Killed Me or Daddy Day Camp or something that Eddie Murphy was attached to. See, didn't I say this was going to happen, Dazza? Eventually we were going to get the rise of high-speed internet, and you'd see less catty people on the list. Like, you know, we'd see the Madonnas and the Arnold Schwarzeneggers, and it's like, okay, we know that already, but, you know, at the time, the Razzies really were their only venue to get sort of to vent, and now I get the feeling now that we've seen the advent of high-speed internet, we're sort of seeing people getting their frustrations or getting their general cattiness out of the way, and now that we've gotten to the Razzies, they're bad movies, but there's not much of a story to go with. It's not people being, you know, maliciously petty. It's now they're just going, okay, these are the films that everybody saw. These are the films that people generally consider the worst. Get on with your business, everybody. This was after the age of the internet message board. So people got their frustrations out in other ways. But by the time 2007 rolled around, it was like, I'm not particularly feeling, you know, spiteful. So let's just be objective now. Let's stop being petty and picking on the usual suspects, and let's just go with let's try to be objective now. And let's pick what people think is, you know, objectively the worst film that came out in that given year.
Yeah, they seem to be as well. If you're looking at the list, they seem to be finding a lot more of the films that were like really, really low key. So the ones that sort of like for example, Who's Your Caddy, which was basically just went straight to DVD. They seem to be basically and films like Bratz, which I don't think sort of did much. You know, but they're basically sort of finding movies that basically sort of like came and just disappeared. You know, and were sort of like, you know, I'm guessing maybe that's part of the internet as well, where these films that, you know. Before, whereas a film had to be sort of quite well known for them to be on their radar, now they're sort of like, you know, finding films which are basically, you know, through word of mouth on the internet and stuff, but basically sort of, you know, they wouldn't have been discovered before.
Well, there you go. God, I was going to make a point now. I forgot what it was. Let's see if I can dial it back just for a second. God, that's my... Oh, you talked about... It's a funny story. So you were talking about that you know that I'm trying to be political here, but I can't really think of it, and it's funny that I use the term political. You know who's a big fan of that film, Who's Your Caddy?
Lulu?
Huh? No. It's funny I use the term political, because like there's somebody that's actually a big fan of that film, and it wouldn't be who you think it'd be. That's the interesting thing too.
Obama?
No. Close though. Bill Clinton. Wait, what? Why the reaction, Dazza?
How do we know that Bill Clinton is a fan of Who's Your Caddy?
Oh, that's interesting, because I think somebody was talking to him, or I think he was doing an interview, and people were asking basically what does he do now, basically now that he has all this free time in his hands now that he's no longer president. I think this was in between when his wife was running. So he's basically, someone asked him, he's like, so now what do you do for fun, Bill? He's like, believe it or not, I really like comedy movies. And have you guys seen this movie, Who's Your Caddy? He's like, I really like it.
Oh, boy.
That was hysterical. Because it was like, you know, and Bill Clinton, obviously, he's busy with his, you know, his multiple, I guess you would say, foundations or his charitable work. So he's not one really to keep his finger on the pulse of fine cinema. So the idea that when Bill Clinton thinks of fine comedy, he goes to Who's Your Caddy?
I wanted to know how he actually managed to get that film, because it's, you know, did somebody bite him as a present, or, you know, did he just sort of, you know, it's, how would he come across to, like a lot of sort of, like, you know, retired people, maybe he's really sort of like, you know, got a passion for golf, and someone said, oh, if you like that, you'll like this film about caddies.
Or maybe he's just like the rest of us, Dazza. I'm sure there's tons of people who, you know, doesn't keep their finger on the pulse of fine cinema, and they see this film sort of just, you know, mass marketed, and it's like, oh, okay, I'll watch this film. And really, they're not like you or me, and are cynical when it comes to their sense of humor or their cinema picks, and they'll just watch it and then be like, okay, it's just dumb fun and I like it. It's like, it's one of these films to where, you know, it's the thing that how can I put it this way? We're so used to our bubble that when people just, you know, just a casual observer of film, they'll be like, oh, this is a film I watched because it was on clearance for $9.99, and it's like, I watched it and I liked it. So it's like, okay. There is something to the effect of the average moviegoer, Dazza.
Yeah.
I know we like to stick our noses up in the air, and we tend to be sometimes pseudo-intellectual when it comes to our film picks, and, you know, that's the reason why I like doing the show with you, because you're of similar mind. But, you know, there's some people that are just like, they got other things going on in their lives, Dazza, and they don't have time to study up on film and do research and find out what's the best of the best. It's like, no, they just want something they could put on, they could sort of half watch and be entertained for 120 minutes.
Speak of intellectualism, I'm going to see the Lego Batman movie tomorrow.
Ooh,
morning.
Me too. That movie looks awesome. I'm sort of ashamed of myself. I haven't watched it already, because that was something I was really looking forward to. How did we get to this? I just want people to realize, how did we start this show off, Dazza, with you talking about your Oscar, you know, the Oscar-worthy films you've been watching, and you're like, oh, these are really great films, and they tell these stories of these really interesting people that really existed in the real world, and these really fine cinema pieces, and now we're talking what? Lego Batman.
Bill Clinton. Oh, Bill Clinton watching Who's the Caddy?
To me, that's the selling point of the show. Anything and everything in between, right?
This is what happens when you don't have a script. And it's better for it.
Exactly. It's better for it. All right, as we start to wrap things up, is there anything as of late you've been reading or writing as of late that you want people to know about?
The thing, the most interesting I've been reading is a book called I'd been wanting to read for ages, and I just got around to reading. It's a book called The Jaws Log by Carl Gottlieb, which is basically Carl Gottlieb was one of the writers of Jaws, and he did a mini diary. Of his time working on the movie. And it is really, you know, a really interesting piece, because Jaws was, you know, I don't think people nowadays would sort of appreciate what a difficult film it was to make. I mean, any time that you're filming on water, that is always sort of leaving it open to basically, basically filming on water is an absolute budget eater. You know, it basically, you know, due to weather and you know, the difficulties and everything, and all the stuff like, you know, salt water getting into equipment and stuff. And it really was an interesting book. The place where it's, I mean, you get a lot of sense of how a film actually gets made. And, you know, going through all the sort of stages of development and sort of like casting and sort of looking for locations. And there's lots of interesting, like, you know, little anecdotes about sort of life with the locals and sort of, you know, problems there and that sort of thing and stuff. And how we're basically, if you ever see a film, an episode of The Simpsons where they make it, where they tried to make a radioactive man movie in Springfield, and the residents pretty much take them for everything that they can and basically sort of impose taxes on them and everything. That's pretty much what happened in Jaws. The townspeople tried to milk them for everything that they could. And the one thing that I did find this point about the book is you didn't get a lot of like talk about the problems. But they talked a lot about the shooting problems and stuff, but you didn't get so much talk about some of the well-known stories about that film, that the Richard Dreyfuss and Robert Shaw sort of did not get on with each other, and were sort of like, you know, and were sort of, there's a lot of anecdotes that I knew about how the sort of at times that the shark would sort of sink and have to be rescued and stuff that weren't in there. So, but I'm guessing this is like one person's recollections of the, you know, so maybe it was just stuff that he didn't personally witness or didn't talk about. But overall, it was sort of like, you know, a really interesting, you know, book. And it did actually, after I finished reading it yesterday, the first thing I did was actually put Jaws in to watch. And it just reminded me of what an absolutely awesome film that is for so many reasons. There's so many, if you're sort of really into your film and you watch that movie, you'll see so many great shots and really creative stuff. And people sort of say, oh, the shark looks face and everything. You know, fuck you, because Jaws was an achievement. You know, to make that film on the water and basically sort of get that shark to look as, you know, to do so as much with that shark that they could at that time was phenomenal. And sharks look weird anyway. If you ever see a shark, an actual real shark, they look weird, but they don't look real, you know, but they have a sort of really plastic feel to them. But Jaws, you know, to me, I've never really done a top 10 list of my favorite films of all time, but I'm pretty sure that Jaws will be like in the top three.
Well, there you go. That's good to know, Dazza. I'm glad you stand with your convictions, Dazza.
Yeah.
All right. I think with that, the way it's going to do it for this week's show, Dazza.
Yep, I'm done.
Yeah, you're done, Gus?
I'm done, Gus.
I forgot. That needs to be our outro. God, I keep forgetting. All right. I'm going to make a mental note now. All right. So from all of us at HeavGuard.com, thanks for checking out this week's show. And as always, check you guys out next week. Adios.
Bye.